You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month, we are joined by Hastings-based crime writer Chris Bridges for an extended interview talking about his brilliant debut novel, Sick to Death. I was really gripped by this twisty, complex book and loved talking to Chris about everything from disability representation in fiction to mining your life experiences to create crime plots and the strange nuances of the publishing industry. I also spoke to Hayley Dunlop about her debut Christmas novel called It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas, which is out now with Hera Books. I have a real soft spot for a cheesy Christmas plot and love talking to Hayley about hers. Hayley actually wrote a chunk of the book at one of my online writing retreats in 2021 during the pandemic, and it was great to catch up and discuss the benefits of forced writing time, something Writers HQ continue to do. So if this sounds appealing to you, do check them out. Kelly from Chapter 34 Books came back on the show to talk about Social Sauna Book Club, a new scheme that brings together book lovers and sauna lovers to discuss books in a sauna. It sounds absolutely brilliant. I love the idea of sweating and synthesizing a book together. They are running in Sussex, but also all over the country. So check out socialsaunabookclub.co.uk to book your place. Finally, I popped into the New Writing South office to chat with Anna Jefferson about their collaboration with Headline Publishers for a day demystifying this funny old industry. The event is brilliant for any aspiring and emerging writers and will help you understand the quirks of the industry. You can get face to face with publishers, editors, agents, and publicists and end the day with an In Conversation with Patrick Gale and Eleanor Shearer, which is actually hosted by me. I adore Patrick Gale. I have for so many years, and Eleanor's book sounds completely brilliant. I cannot wait to read it, so I am very excited about this. As you probably know by now, the Brighton Book Club is also a podcast which you can download wherever you get yours. I will pop details of everything we've spoken about today on the show notes. Make sure you follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club, where I will include details of everything we've talked about on the show and often share interesting book related things going on in Sussex and the surrounding areas. If you enjoy the show, please consider supporting it by donating to Radio Reverb. We are completely independent, and it is your generous donations which help keep us on air and ad-free. Enjoy the show. Meet Emma. Emma is sick. She can't work because of a neurological condition, so is stuck in her family's tiny council house. Emma is sick of being told to get over it. Her stepfather, her doctors, strangers, everyone has an opinion. Emma is sick of being the other woman. Her boyfriend Adam is perfect. He's got a great job and an amazing home. His wife Celeste is the problem. Emma is sick of being underestimated. All she needed was a target, and now she has Celeste. Emma is sick, just not in the way you thought. I am joined by Chris Bridges in the Brighton Book Club studio to talk about his brilliant debut thriller, Sick to Death. Chris, welcome.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
When did the idea for this novel first come to you?
Oh gosh, so it's a few years back. I was walking the dog down the street. I'd had a failed novel on submission, so I wrote a book about a group of nurses, because I was a nurse, a crime thriller. Not one of those psycho nurse books, because I'm not into all that. It was kind of more about a domestic murder between friends, you know, that kind of thing. Keep murdering in the friendship group. And it failed completely when I tried to get an agent. So I was kind of wandering down the street and I saw a man in a small bedroom at the window typing, like obviously working from home. And I kind of had this thought. I thought, has he kicked someone out of that bedroom to use it? And then it just all started from there. And I've got a chronic illness, I've got MS, so I kind of extrapolated what was going on with me in my life, and I kind of started to think, and by the end of the dog walk, I'd kind of come up with this thought, and I thought, what if I didn't have the things that I've got? So what if I didn't have a secure job, or a pension, or, you know, fallback? What if I didn't have a partner who cared about me? What if I didn't have a friendship group? What if I didn't have a dog? You know, those kind of things, just all of those things. And I thought, how far would it take before I was prepared to do something quite drastic, or I was kind of ripe for the picking to kind of for someone else to ask me to help them do something drastic?
It's such a brilliant book, and there are so many themes in it, right? Like, this is a book that explores a lot. It explores family, class, illness. It explores the lengths that people will go to seek revenge, the things that people will do for money. Did you find, were the stakes always so high when you were writing it, or did they get higher and higher as your writing went?
I think they maybe got a little bit higher. I think they were always there because that idea I'd had of kind of like the desperation of illness. I think I've gone through lots of stages. I was diagnosed in 2020 with relapsing remitting MS, and although I'm moderately functional, I get chronic fatigue, which is, I think, when people think about multiple sclerosis, they think about like limited mobility as a kind of go-to. But MS is such a spectrum of illness. There's so many different facets to it. And for me, it's things like sort of pain, sensory issues. I had a very long route to diagnosis, which is a whole other hour-long podcast. But when I was finally diagnosed, there were so many feelings that I had, like so much like anger, so much fear, so much sadness. And I kind of tried to let myself go through all of those feelings. And I think lots of those feelings came out in the book. And I felt this strange responsibility to represent sickness, which was a bit silly of me, really. As I was writing the book, I kept thinking, oh my gosh, I'm like representing the whole of chronic illness. Like, all of the people, every single person who's got chronic illness, which is mad. I was just representing an experience, an imagined experience of chronic illness, partly based on my own thoughts. Lots of those things kind of came into it as I was writing the book. I'd kind of think, yeah, I'm going to make her a working class character. There was a lot of rationale. I talk a lot, don't I? There was a rationale for kind of why I went where I went. So I kind of thought about it. So I've always been a person who doesn't read much nonfiction, and I'm a voracious fiction reader. I've always read about three or four books a week, and now I've had to retire due to the health problems I've got, and I read about five books a week often. And I've always looked to fiction for answers, and I've always sort of found them. I've always found that if something's going on in my life, like if I've got an unfaithful boyfriend, or which has happened, if I've got depression, which I had a stress burnout at work, there's always a book. Kind of, I remember being really depressed, and it was a book by Marion Keyes that really helped me. And it kind of actually, that was kind of more helpful to me than anything else. But when I got sick, there wasn't anything in fiction that kind of correlated with my experience. So I thought I'd like to write a book where it's about sickness, but it's not about sickness. So it's a book where it's like the book's a crime thriller, so it's about a crime. But sick people in fiction tend to be assigned certain roles. So you've got the kind of love story kind of thing where the Ally McGraw character in the film she's got an illness, she's got leukemia or whatever it was, and then there's a story arc, and then she dies at the end. Or you've got something like The Salt Path, maybe not such a good example now after what's happened, but where a character's got a terrible illness, they do something, and then that helps them to overcome or come to terms with the illness and all of that. So they're the two main story arcs that people with illness in books have, is either die or get better. And there's a kind of third one that sometimes crops up, which is be proven to be a fake, which is where you get a midpoint twist where it's like shock, horror, gasp, they've been putting it on, or their mum's got Munchausen's by proxy, or that kind of thing. So I wanted the book not to be any of those things. And this minor spoiler alert, but there's a point in the book where Emma, the main character, said, I've not got better. I've not died. That was never going to be my story. And it's kind of the fact that her illness remains is within the story. I think for me, I've got this chronic illness where I don't have a dramatic story arc with it, really, to be honest. Most of the time, like I'll have a couple of days where I don't feel so bad, then I'll have a few days where I feel quite bad, and it just trundles along. And my life expectancy is only a couple of years less than someone without MS. So all of that, I've talked a lot, haven't I? Do this.
Can we hear an extract, please, Chris? This feels like a good time.
So bear in mind that this has been the character who's speaking is actually a woman in her 30s. So that's not me, but I'll have a go. So my stepfather isn't there when I arrive home. I can always tell when he's here from the moment I open the door. He emanates this musky smell from his aftershave. He's a 90s relic, red cheeks doused in designer fragrance. Mum and Becky will still be at work and Ava at the school holiday club that she goes to. Vassetti welcomes me. My cat Sparrow jumps up and curls up against my legs, purring, and my hand touches the silk of her fur. I'm still half asleep when he comes in, but I sense him, his breath, the change in the atmosphere. I feel the cat jump off my legs and hear her feet as she runs from the room. She avoids Peter and Winston, the wheezy bulldog who follows at his heels, drooling onto the carpet. Productive day again, then. His mouth forms a sneer. I know you're awake. There's no one else here but us, Emma. I turn my face to the wall, hoping he'll go away, knowing that he won't. Don't ignore me in my own house. We all bend over backwards for you, don't we? Tiptoeing around you and this bloody illness. It's not like it's even. I sit up, the blood rushing from my face, the room receding. But it's not, though, is it? It's not your house, Peter. It's my mum's, isn't it? Staring straight ahead, I concentrate on the gaps where my father's things should be. The books, his clocks, the pictures of him, the negative spaces that scrape away at me. They were all packed away within weeks of Peter moving in. He didn't do it all in one go, but moved them bit by bit. My father gradually eroded. The one remaining photo of me and my parents now pushed back, outranked by a larger one of Peter and Mum grinning on the registrar's office steps. I walk away, my eyes averted, making a steady exit. I resist the urge to run at him and make his skull ricochet off the wall, to hear the exquisite crumpling of bones and flesh as he falls to the floor and watch him flail around helplessly before me. I don't think that I'm alone in having these thoughts, the fantasies that inhabit our subconscious, the daydream of punching an obnoxious colleague in the face, that idle thought of how satisfying it would be to push a troublesome family member to the ground, to sink a knife into the ribs of a tyrant.
Thank you so much, Chris. I love how the novel really keeps you guessing. And I really love, actually, the way that you explore friendship in the book and female friendship in particular. And was wondering if you could speak to that a bit.
Yeah. Quite a few people have asked me since the book came out why I chose to write in a female voice. And I think for me, that was always a given that I would. Funnily enough, when I was writing dialogue with the straight male character in the book, the editor kept sending it back to me. And eventually, after about four goes, I just sent one back saying, I don't know how straight men talk anymore. She was like, okay, we're going to have to give you a hand here. But yeah, I think the reason I chose a female voice was because chronic autoimmune illnesses are more prevalent in females. The kind of illness that Emma has is more prevalent in females. I've also spent my whole life surrounded by women. So kind of female friendship is something I'm very familiar with. So all of my friendship group at school were women, girls. And then when I started work, I originally worked in retail for a couple of years after failing my A-levels and then trained to be a nurse, which was a predominantly female profession at the time. So it felt like a given that I'd kind of go with a female voice. I like the idea of friendship there. I think that felt like a really important thing. It's really hard to talk about the books. It's so twisty and kind of it's so easy to reveal stuff. But I like the idea of kind of mismatched friendships as well between people of different social classes. There's a bit that's not a spoiler. So Emma actually meets another ill person in the book as well, who becomes a friend and a cautionary voice. And I liked the idea of that as well, because I think for me, I found really strong camaraderie amongst people who are ill. I think it's quite one of the amazing things about having a friend who's ill. I'm not saying that other people don't understand, because they can and they do and they try really hard. But it's so easy with someone who's got the same illness, because you don't have to explain things. You'll just say something like, oh, yeah, I had to go for this procedure. And they'll be like, oh, okay. And you don't have to explain a single thing, and they just get it, and kind of it's all there. I liked that idea. The social class thing as well was a big thing for me, because we moved to London like 12 years ago, and I would say I was in between it all. So it shocked me, because I came from the Midlands, and in the Midlands everybody is segregated in a way. So you kind of get like suburban areas that are quite wealthy, you get areas that are quite poverty stricken. You don't get the kind of mix that you get in London, where you'll walk down the street and there's kind of huge like 10-bedroom houses, and then you've got a block of council flats kind of thing. That doesn't happen out in other places so much. So I'd say that I was kind of in the middle, because I was earning a moderate salary, but I was surrounded by very wealthy people, and also witnessed some grinding, horrific poverty that I saw in my job as a nurse, because I was working in Southeast London. So that was something that really intrigued me. I like the idea of kind of haves and have nots. I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, money is always there with crime, isn't it? It's often a thing, isn't it? It's one of the main things.
So, Chris, you obviously have had this whole career before you started writing. Yeah. Was writing a book something that you always wanted to do? Was it at the back of your mind? You mentioned failing your A-levels as well.
Okay, yeah. So when I was at school, when I was about seven, and they made us all write a story, and I won for the whole school. And I won this little plastic machine that dispensed tiny chocolate bars when you put 2p in it. So I kind of thought, oh, okay, so this is like something you can make money with, like writing a story. Maybe I don't have to be one of the kids from Fame because I can't really dance or sing. So I decided I was going to be a journalist, and then I had this whole thing planned out. I was going to be a journalist. And then in the evenings, I would write this killer literary fiction highbrow novel, maybe the odd poem. and anyway, then I kind of had this bit of teenage trauma where my mental health wasn't brilliant. And I ended up flunking my A-levels completely and leaving home to live with a much older man. So that all just did not happen. And I went to work in a shop. I went to work in Woolworths, of all places, which is a blast from the past. For anybody who's over a certain age. And then I was working at Woolworths, and I kind of thought, I've got to get out of this. This is not what I want to do. I mean, nothing wrong with working in retail if that's what suits you, but it just did not suit me. And so I was trying to find a way to get back in to go to university, because I'd originally got a place at Manchester to study English literature, where I'm not entirely sure this dream of being a journalist and then writing novels in the evening would have happened. It usually doesn't, does it, with life. So I was talking to a friend, and she was a nurse. She trained to be a nurse, and you actually got paid to be a nurse when you did your training at that point in time. You don't now. You have to get a student loan like any other thing. So you actually got paid a salary. So I thought, oh my God, this is something that I could actually do, because I could afford to do it, because the salary was almost equivalent to retail. So I started my nurse training having no idea what I was going into. I'd probably seen like one episode of a drama about hospital once, and maybe visited my gran once when she had a heart attack. That was it. I had literally no idea what a nurse did. I was clueless. But I loved it from the first day. I thought it was fascinating, all the people and the stories, and I just loved all of that aspect. And right from the very start, I decided I wanted to work with people who were terminally ill or at the end of their life. That was what I wanted to do right from the beginning. So I kind of worked my way up, and had a plan of what I was going to do. And I eventually, it took me a long time to get there because I got sidetracked by other things. I eventually became a palliative care specialist nurse, which I loved. That kind of, I think I wasn't a very technical nurse. I wasn't that kind of nurse, and wasn't a very routine driven nurse. I liked something that was kind of quite narrative.
So all of that you can see in also the character of Bobby in the book. You know, it's not a spoiler. That Bobby, who is the brother of one of the main characters in the book, is terminally ill. So I would assume that your experience as a palliative care nurse drew into that. So you know, you're a nurse, you're nursing, you're working in palliative care. How do you go from that to writing a book and then getting published?
So just going back to Bobby as well and the terminal illness, so I've gone even harder in the next book. So I've got another book coming out in February, which is called The Deathbed, and that's about a nurse who's got terminal illness. So I've really gone there. So what happened was I was unexpectedly single in my 30s and hadn't really done any writing whatsoever, but was a voracious reader, like just read constantly. A little bit of crime, but any kind of fiction, I would read anything. Apart from like westerns or something about sport or whatever. But I saw there was an evening course going on at a local art cinema, and it was a creative writing course. So I went to that, and the tutor was so encouraging and was like really enthusiastic about my writing. And I was like, seriously? So I entered a competition, which was for the whole of the region. I lived in the East Midlands, and won. It was a flash fiction competition, and they gave me 50 quid as a prize. And I had to go to this awards ceremony at a stately home. It was really bizarre. It was just like, what the hell just happened? So from that moment, I thought, okay, this is it. I'm a writer now. I'm going to do it. So I started entering short stories to competitions. and didn't win a single one, didn't get placed, didn't get anything printed in a magazine, and my confidence just went again. It was like, done, that was it. And so in the interim, I started writing theatre reviews for a website and got free theatre tickets for doing it, and started writing a column. It was like, it was a queer website, but predominantly for gay men. And then when we moved to London, I started writing for a London-based events website. And that kind of sated my urge to write. And then I did a weird thing. So I'm like, I call myself a reverse COVID writer. So the pandemic hit and lots of people were furloughed and wrote the novel they always wanted to write. I did the opposite. I was like working more than ever before. So I was like working with people who were dying of COVID. And I decided to write a novel. And the reason was I heard a thing or I saw it on somewhere for Radio 4. It was a shout out and they wanted people's COVID stories. And they were going to read them out on the radio and then immortalise them in the British Library and this archive. And I thought, oh, that sounds amazing. And my COVID experience was a little bit weird, like kind of completely different from most other people's. Because rather than being at home, I was in a hospital. And I thought I could write something that was quite soothing about death and kind of try and contextualise it and kind of say, you know, this is what's happening. You know, there is kindness and care there. So I wrote it, not expecting to hear back. And they got back to me within a few hours and said, can you read it out for tomorrow's PM show? And I was like, what the hell? So, and it was that, just that moment made me think, right, I've got to do it. This is it. And I think I'd been diagnosed with MS a few months before. And I think I hate doing this, being that kind of inspo porn as well. I think, you know, I was never going to run a marathon or, you know, climb Ben Nevis or something. That wasn't going to happen. I'm not that person. But I think this was probably my marathon, I'm ashamed to say, but I don't want to be seen as inspirational porn. It was difficult trying to do it. And in the interim, kind of, you know, I think I was a bit better then. My illness wasn't quite as bad as it is now. So I'd got the energy to work and do that. That was when I wrote this novel, which was the book about a friendship group of nurses, which didn't succeed. So I sent that out to about 10 agents. I read all the stuff in the Writer's and Artist Yearbook about what to do, how to do a cover letter, all of that, and a synopsis. Sent this book off thinking, okay, something might happen, nothing. So I sent it to another 10 and another 10 and another 10. So I sent it to about 60 agents all in and I got two responses back and both of them said, we really like the way that you write and we like your writing style, we think your voice, but we just don't like the story. So I was like, oh, okay, that's really positive. So I took that as a positive. I read this article by a writer that said that she made it into a game, because I'm not very good at rejection, I hate it. So she made rejection into a game that she could win at. She was like, I'm going to try and aim for 100 rejections. So I was like, okay, let's do that. So I got to a point, I did actually get to a point where another rejection would come and I'd think, yay, I'm like earning my stripes. You know, this is like kind of getting your little stars on the McDonald's badge. I'm doing the thing that you've got to do. So I wrote started writing Sick to Death. Which was called something completely different. And I saw a thing, it was a London-based, because I was still living in London at the time, it was a London-based award for people from underrepresented backgrounds in publishing. So basically working class people from global majority or minority ethnic, whichever you want to call it, LGBTQ people, disabled people, chronically ill people, all sorts. So I applied and I got on the programme and it was an amazing programme. It's called the London Writers Award. Sorry, Sussex-based people, it's not for you, but you have to live in London. And it was like a nine-month programme with lectures, support, like feedback groups, and it was the most amazing thing. And then at the end of that, I got an agent.
That's an amazing story. And obviously now you're a published author, you've got one book out and another one, you know, being cooked up now to be released in early 26. What has surprised you about the publishing industry?
Oh my gosh, so many things. This is a whole other 2-hour podcast, not the hour one about my diagnosis. So much. I think I'd romanticise publishing. I think most writers tend to do that and you don't quite think how commercial it is, that it's a business. You know, you don't think that, you kind of think of Charlotte Bronte on the moors with an ink pen and all of that. But publishing is a business and they've got to make money, and it can be that really talented people go without publishing contracts because their book is probably not thought to not be one that's going to make money. You know, I've had people who I know who've got the most brilliant books, but they're just, it's just not the right time or place for them. And that's, it's quite, quite devastating to kind of see that.
Yeah, for sure. It can be really brutal. And, you know, you've spoken before about the kind of intersections, really, of your of your marginalization. How do you think, you know, do you feel, how do you feel about these kind of publishing schemes to represent, you know, underrepresented writers? And do you feel like they are genuinely beneficial, or there's still more work to be done?
I think there is a risk that they're just doing lip service. I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it? When we put Sick to Death out in submission, so the main character, the protagonist, is unlikable to an extent. She's angry and she's got an inner sort of violence within her. But I didn't feel like she was unlikable. I thought there was lots about her to like. But the biggest sort of feedback we constantly got was that readers would not relate to her because she's unlikable. And I kind of started to think, is this coded language for readers will not relate to her because she's not well? You know, kind of, whether that was me being paranoid or not, I don't know. I think these schemes are good, you know, and I do know people who've ended up being published sort of via these schemes, lots of people. So I think, you know, it's brilliant that they do that, and it's a sort of stepping stone into the publishing world. And I think the landscape of publishing has definitely changed. You know, definitely there wouldn't have been so many mainstream queer books or so many mainstream books with global majority characters like 10 years ago, 20 years ago for definite. But I think we're still not there. There's a lot more work to be done. And I think there's lots of marginalised groups. There's a whole argument about appropriation as well. I mean, there's this whole thing, isn't there, of female romance writers who write these male romances that are fine. And my take on that is if they do it well, then it's fine. I don't care. As long as it's written well. You know, I've read some great literary fiction books about queer characters that were like In Memoriam, which is beautifully written by a woman, so absolutely fine. Who am I to speak? Who's written a book from the point of view of mainly of two women?
Who gets to write what is a whole other podcast, Chris? That's I could obviously
3-hour one.
3-hour one. I could talk to you for hours, and I hope we get to do that one day. But I would just really like to quickly talk about the fact that you're now based in the southeast. You've recently moved to St. Leonard's.
Yeah, yeah.
What is it like to be a writer down here?
Beautiful. I love it. I've got so my history with this area of, well, Sussex goes back a long way. So when I was 18, back in at the end of the 80s, I came down to Brighton and we went to a gay bar, me and my much older boyfriend, and we were standing in the gay bar and I was terrified, absolutely terrified, but not for the reasons you might think. And I turned to my boyfriend and I said, "Oh my God, they've got a glass window." And he was like, "What do you mean?" And I was like, because where I came from, gay bars did not have windows. It was like impossible because bricks would come through them. So I felt like Brighton was the most amazing place. And that was when I fell in love with Sussex. And over the years, I've spent so much time in Brighton and always kind of thought, I'll either live in Brighton or Hastings. And Hastings won. But it's a really good place. There's a big community of writers in Hastings. It's a really arty place. I think all along this coast, I think it just draws in people. I think it's more difficult. I think for me, with being ill, I have to like moderate my activity. So I have to kind of be really careful what I do. And often the things that happen are very London based. So that's quite a difficult thing because I just can't do them. I've kind of isolated myself. I always laugh and say that it's one of those like Victorian novels where the invalid goes down to the seaside to recover. That's me, Danny Hastings.
Brilliant. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on the Brighton Book Club. How can we find and follow you and hear about your next book when it's out?
So at Chris Bridges Writer is my Instagram moniker, and I've got a Facebook Chris Bridges Writer page. I gave up Twitter because of the moral unsoundness of it. The new book's out in February. So the new book is about a nurse who's living up in the north of England, and she finds out that her former best friend is dying of cancer. And because of the Icelandic ash cloud, it's set in 2010, she hasn't got anyone there with her to look after her. So she feels compelled to go down. Unfortunately, there's a dark history between them. And 15 years before, at the end of their nurse training, there was a tragedy. And the woman who's dying knows all of the secrets. And so part of her going down to look after her is also partly to make sure she keeps quiet. So, yeah.
Oh,
so
my it's a God.
Split timeline book between the 90s and between 2010.
Brilliant. Chris, thank you so much for joining us. Sick to Death is out now, and I highly recommend it.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Can life be like a made-for-TV Christmas movie? Mally Alistair prides herself on being nice and predictable, just like the trope-filled festive films she turns to for comfort every winter. But when she faces the prospect of spending Christmas alone in her London flat, Mally is sent on a writing assignment to try to recreate the cheesy Christmas movie experience in her humdrum British hometown. With the help of familiar faces from her formative years, including her teenage crush Tom, Mally starts ticking off the classic holiday romance movie tropes in unexpected ways. But can real life ever live up to the magical movie experience? Hayley Dunlop, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much for having me, Anna.
Congratulations on the publication of your first novel. How does it feel to have it about to come out into the world?
It feels amazing. Funnily enough, it did actually get published in August, which was even more surreal because having to promote a Christmas book during multiple heat waves in the summer was something of a creative challenge, but one that I relished. So yeah, it's been out for a couple of months already. The response to it has been so lovely. And yeah, it's just been like, it feels like it's been such a long time coming for this story because I wrote it sort of back in 2020, 2021. So yeah, it took a good few years for it to find its readers, but it means the world that it finally is.
And that's really how we met, isn't it? Because I've slightly broken my own rule in that you are not based in the Southeast. But I'd love it if you could tell the listeners a little bit about the involvement of the Brighton Book Club in writing it together.
Yeah, absolutely. So this book wouldn't exist without co-writing as a principle in general, but when I started writing this book, everything was in lockdown. I had never even considered myself to be a creative writer. I'd always been like a copywriter. I'd always worked in comms. I was very much like quite a functional writer. And then lockdown happened. I kind of lost my mind and I found co-writing groups to be like my savior, basically. So I joined a number of co-writing groups over lockdown and started writing with other people online sort of regularly once a week or so. And I found it so comforting and cathartic to be able to share that experience with other people who were like also struggling up and down the country. And it was during those sessions that I actually started to think about the possibility of writing this story, which isn't something that I'd ever thought I would be writing, a cheesy rom-com. I was always quite a serious writer, writing about like big topics, very much geared towards kind of like essays and nonfiction. But then because the world was quite bleak at the time, I just wanted to lean into this idea of writing something that would bring me comfort. And then I found out about the Brighton Book Club and about the fact that you were doing all of these co-writing sort of virtual writing retreats over lockdown. So I think this was back in 2021. And in these sessions, it would be like a whole day where we would come together virtually. Obviously, we literally couldn't come together in person at that time. And we would spend the whole day writing in sprints, doing check-ins, chatting to each other. And I remember the first one I did, some point in sort of early 2021, I think, we did this kind of collective word count and we all figured out how much we'd written over the course of that day. And it was something like we'd written a whole novel's worth of words, you know, like 90,000, 100,000 words. And I found that so inspiring that this, despite how hard the world was and how troubling the times were and how difficult we were all finding it, we had come together and we had like created stuff. And that gave me just such an amazing feeling. And yeah, I made some really good progress on this book with co-writing through the Brighton Book Club. And yeah, this book basically wouldn't exist without co-writing. There's something really magical about coming together, I think, either in person or virtually, just having that accountability where you're writing with other people. You are accountable, you're checking in, you're writing kind of in quite a healthy way because you're like got breaks factored in, which is obviously something when you're minded to hyperfixate, as I am, you can sometimes stop to, you can forget to stop to kind of like look after yourself. So yeah, I loved those days so much. Not lockdown as a whole, that was horrific, but those days when my husband would take the kids, I've got two children, he would look after the kids, like I would shut myself away in this room in the house and just spend the whole day with my characters and my story, and it was just an absolute dream. I loved those days so much.
That's brilliant, Hayley. Right, let's get back to the book because I'm blushing. So let's hear an extract and then I really want to talk about why Christmas.
Yeah, let's crack on. So yeah, the context of this extract I'm about to read is that she's back in her hometown, which is a fictional suburb of Bristol, which is actually where I grew up. And she's about to meet her teenage crush for a date, or is it? I took a few steps back onto the landing and smoothed down the skirt of my cold shoulder midi dress as I turned and twisted my neck to catch microscopic glimpses of myself from various angles. The dress was an old favourite, a dark emerald green colour with a sweetheart neckline and skater style skirt that skimmed and hugged in all the right places. Best of all, it had properly deep pockets, which made it perfect for work events when, more often than not, I had no idea what to do with my hands. Elle called it my Mary Berry dress, as she'd seen her wear something similar on the Great British Bake Off Christmas special one time. But unlike me, Elle never struggled to find clothes that looked good on her. She was one of those people who could throw on an oversized sweater and look effortlessly cool and stylish, whereas in the very same top, I'd end up looking like Miss Trunchbull teaching PE. Like Dame Mary, my go-to dress was classy, reliable, and timeless. I knew I looked all right in it. Best of all, its heavy fabric meant that it never needed ironing and still looked freshly pressed, despite being screwed up into a ball at the bottom of my suitcase all week. Hopefully, with my thick black tights and simple ankle boots, it struck the right balance between potential festive date and just threw this outfit together, no big deal. The car was right on time, a disconcertingly silent Prius, no less. The driver sporting a Santa hat and in chatty spirits as we began the 25-minute journey into town. 10 minutes into the drive, I spotted the old chocolate factory where my nan used to work in the on-site discount shop. Posh flats now, of course. A snort of hilarity erupted from my throat as an old memory catapulted itself to the front of my mind. The noise caught the driver's attention as he glanced at me in the rearview mirror. "You're all right, love?" "Yeah, I'm good." I was full on cackling now. "Sorry, I just remembered something really funny about the chocolate factory." "Well, go on then, don't leave me hanging." I told him about the time my grandparents had been on holiday in Devon and had decided to treat themselves to a mystery coach trip. 90 minutes later, the coach pulled into her work car park for a tour and chocolate tasting, her colleagues baffled as to why she was buying bargain bags of broken biscuits with a gaggle of tourists when she was meant to be on holiday. The anecdote went down well with the driver, and I enjoyed sharing it. It had been one of my grampy's favourite stories, which we'd begged him to retell over and over. I'd always assumed that letting my frozen memories thaw would do nothing but remind me of everything that had broken in my life. But joy and comforting nostalgia were also beginning to fill in the cracks. And just like Grampy used to say to us every time he brought home a massive bag of seconds for us from the chocolate factory shop, broken biscuits might well be broken, but they're still delicious.
That is lovely. Thank you so much. So, Hayley, you've said previously that, you know, you were quite a serious writer before. Mm-hmm. And this is a kind of, I mean, look, rom-com is like my favourite genre ever. About Christmas, what made you decide to write this book and set it at Christmas?
Well, just setting the scene a little bit, I started writing this in November 2020. And as you'll remember, the nation was in lockdown. Christmas had literally been cancelled by the government. Everybody's spirits were, I would say, probably rock bottom. And I was really struggling to like engage with any stories at all back then. And then I started to watch cheesy Christmas movies on Channel 5. You know, those like made for TV ones where the woman always goes back to her hometown from her high flying city job and ends up sort of rekindling a romance with her high school sweetheart. And I was just watching these films over and over again. And it was the same film, essentially. Like the formula was exactly the same. The tropes were there. And I was finding such deep comfort in them. And I couldn't figure out why. Because intellectually, I knew they were, you know, inverted commas, bad. But they were just making me just feel so, like, safe and comforted. But then I began to think about, well, hang on a second. What would happen if like a nerdy British woman went back to her hometown that she'd not been back to for ages? Like, this wouldn't happen, would it? You know, this is all just a fantasy, basically. And then like the scenario just wouldn't leave me alone in my mind. And I thought it would actually be quite funny if this woman went back to her hometown that she'd not been back to in years, sort of meaningfully trying to experience a cheesy Christmas movie.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was watching all of these movies, I actually developed my own game of Christmas movie bingo, where I was sort of listing all the tropes from these films. And like with friends, we would watch the films and tick off all these tropes. And then that became kind of the backbone for the novel itself. So each chapter begins with the main character, Mally, ticking off one of these Christmas movie tropes that she's experiencing in real life. But obviously, the way that she's experiencing it isn't necessarily the same as what she's expecting. There's quite a lot of subversion going on with these tropes, and there's quite a lot of it's quite a sad story in many ways, because she hasn't been back to her hometown in 20 years, and the story explores why.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she starts to see that even though her Christmas in this hometown isn't necessarily the picture perfect Christmas from the made for TV Christmas movies, there's still magic to be found in like the grey Christmas of suburban England. Yeah, so that's why I ended up writing a Christmas story, to kind of bring me comfort.
Mm.
So the fact that it's now bringing other people comfort as well, the feedback has just been so lovely. People saying it's like a warm hug, you know, wrapped, it's like you're sat on a chair wrapped in a blanket, and this book is just like a warm hug. And that's exactly how it felt when I was writing it. So it's just been such a joy having those responses.
What's next for you, Hayley? What are you working on?
So I was contracted by my publisher, which is Hera Books, to write a second Christmas rom-com. So again, that wasn't on the cards. I thought, do you know what? I've done the Christmas rom-com now. Tick that one off the list. But they were really keen for me to write another festive rom-com. So my second novel comes out next summer. Again, another summer publication, but I'm going to embrace it. It's all fun. And this one is going to be set in New York, so it's sort of as far away from the kind of like humdrum British suburb as you can imagine. It's set in New York, and it's been an absolute joy to write. I've been working on it all this year, and I can't wait for that one to come out too.
Congratulations so much, Hayley, on the publication of It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas, which is out now with Hera Books. How can we find and follow you?
So I'm on Instagram at Hayley J Dunlop, also on TikTok at the same. And I also have a Substack newsletter, which is called Becoming an Author. And you can look me up at HayleyJDunlop.substack.com.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm really excited about this next segment because anyone who knows me loves to love a book, obviously. But I also love a sauna and I also really love independent bookshops. So I'm really, really happy to be joined by Kelly from Chapter 34 Books in Shoreham to tell me more about the Social Sauna Book Club, which has just launched all across the UK saunas. Kelly, welcome back.
Hello. Yes, very excited about this. The first Social Sauna Book Club took place on Thursday. So yes, it's a very exciting time.
What's the idea behind the Social Saunas Book Club? What does it look like?
The idea came from a night we hosted at the bookshop. We had the fabulous Emma O'Kelly along with her book Wild Sauna, where it's a directory of all the incredible saunas that have popped up over the UK. And we had a full house for 2 nights. And I got talking to lots of the people, and I thought, hang on a minute. There is a crossover here. I'm one of those people. You are one of those people. Love a book. Love a book club. Love saunas. So that's kind of when the penny dropped. And I thought, hang on a minute, we could do something here. So yeah, the way it works is really, really simple. You go onto the website, socialsaunabookclub.co.uk, find your sauna, book your seat, and then I send you the book of the month in the post for you to read before you go to the sauna and talk to the people in the sauna about the book, like you would at a normal book club.
It's an absolutely brilliant idea. So you're working with saunas all across the southeast, aren't you?
Yes, October's saunas sold out quite quickly. We've got the Nomadic Sauna in Southwick, in this area, Widewater Sauna down in Lancing, and Saunadelic at Hove Lagoon. They're all the local ones that will have read for October. Night Swimmers by Roisin Maguire, and then we've got a whole lot of other saunas joined for November.
And I know that your book for November is Goodbye Birdie Greenwing by Erica Waller, who I absolutely love. Can you tell us why you decided to choose this book?
Of course, the choosing of the book for this particular book club is quite tricky, simply because you're in a sauna. You're hot. I don't know if you've ever experienced sauna brain, but I certainly have. I forget everything as soon as I'm in there. So I'm having to choose books that appeal to both sexes. I want them to have a sense of community. I don't want anything too long, too involved, but equally, I want brilliant fiction. So that was why I chose book Goodbye Birdie Greenwing, because I love the book myself. I know Erica, and I just think the characters will really appeal to lots of people.
So, are these sessions facilitated? Do you have someone who goes along to kind of run them? Or is the idea that all these people arrive who have read the same book and the conversation starts naturally?
That is how it'll work. So what will happen is all those people will be reading the same book, and then a few days before their session, I send them kind of a list of talking points, nothing too involved again, and just a suggestion of how they will run it. They'll get in the sauna, introduce themselves, and then there's a few talking points. Some of the sauna hosts have also requested a book so that they can kind of pop in, and when they put a log in the fire, they can say, "Oh, what did you think of this character?" and kind of get the conversation going. And people don't have to worry about staying in the sauna for the whole time. It's not like you must sit there in the heat. People can get in and out whenever they want.
There's something really lovely about the idea of sitting in a sauna, like away from a screen. You know, there's a lot of value to, you know, the things that we do online, but I think there's also so much value to the moments we have in person, really, really connecting with each other. Was this one of the ideas behind social saunas?
Absolutely. During that night when Emma O'Kelly was here with her book, I got the conversation turned to the joy of being in a sauna and not having access to a screen, having it completely removed from you. So you know, you are there appreciating where you are at that point in time. And that's the same with a book. And I just think more and more people are looking for activities that don't involve screens, that don't involve alcohol, that are just times to connect with other people. And some people I know have booked into these sessions are going completely alone. Some are going with someone they know. You know, it's, I think it's going to be a lovely community experience.
Can you name some of the saunas that people can get involved with the Social Sauna Book Club?
Yes. Yeah, so in the next load in November, our local ones will be Saunadelic, that's at Hove Lagoon, beautiful sauna run by fabulous Faye, and the Nomadic Sauna at Kingston Beach, where the lighthouse is here in Shoreham. But then across the country, we have got Wild Scottish Sauna. We have got Samphire Sauna, which is on Hastings Pier. So that should be a really fun one. Peak Saunas in the Peak District. Schooner Saunas, which is actually a floating sauna on Canary Wharf. Mm-hmm. And Thai Sauna in Wales. So, yeah, we're really going for it, and hoping to add more in December.
It's such a brilliant idea, Kelly. I wish you all the best of luck with it and really hope I can come along someday soon. How can people find out more?
If you go to the website, socialsaunabookclub.co.uk, everything you need to know is on there. That's how you book your seat. And I'm also on Instagram at socialsaunabookclub.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
New Writing South are back with another brilliant publishing and industry day at the Old Courthouse in November on the 15th in the afternoon. And I have popped into the New Writing South office to talk to Anna Jefferson about what we can expect from their Demystifying Publishing event. Anna, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the Demystifying Publishing event.
We're really excited about this because this is the first time that we've worked with Headline, and we're hoping this will be the start of a longer term partnership with them. They've been hugely generous in terms of what they're going to be doing with us on that day. It's a day, as you say, really about demystifying publishing. We're looking specifically this year as well to make sure that we can engage with writers, emerging writers who do really struggle to find themselves reflected on UK bookshelves. So it'll be a really good opportunity for people to really get kind of under the skin of what it is to get books published and have some face-to-face time with people who work in the industry. So yeah, they're going to come down and spend an afternoon with us. They're going to bring publishers with them, some agents, editors, people who work in sales, marketing and publicity. So it really will be an all-round experience. And also, we're really excited because the day is going to end with a Meet the Authors with Patrick Gale and Elna Shearer, who are going to be bringing some proof copies of some of their new books as well.
So for any aspiring novelists listening, what would they get from this day?
So the thing that I think makes this day different from our publishing industry days that some of your listeners might have been to is that this is going to be a much more kind of intimate situation. So it's not going to be rake seating, it's going to be everybody in the old courtroom, so you can all get to meet people face to face. We're going to be having some panel events, and for some of the writers who'll come along as well, there'll be an opportunity to have some one-to-ones as well. So the afternoon is going to start with a panel which is called From Idea to Book Deal, and this is going to be meeting with agents and editors and an opportunity for them to talk about what they do and also for writers to be able to ask questions of them. We're going to follow that with another panel as well, which is around reaching readers, and that will be talking to the sales, the marketing and the publicity team. And again, these might be the kind of questions about how books end up in Kindle sales, or how do you get your book into bookshops, and just, you know, looking at things from beginning to end as well, but what that end might look like as well from a publisher's perspective. And then we've got quite an exciting speed date, a publisher. And so this is going to be a series of one-to-ones, quickfire one-to-ones with people who work with and for the organisation. And then we're going to finish the day with the Meet the Authors with Patrick and Eleanor.
It sounds absolutely brilliant, Anna. How can people book tickets and how many do you have left?
So we are well over halfway booked for the day. So if any of your listeners are interested, then now's the time to get booking. If you look at the New Writing South website, which is newwritingsouth.com, and there will be a link for the Demystifying Publishing with Headline event. And if you click through that, then be able to buy some tickets. The tickets are all set at £30, but we also have tickets at £30, but we also have concessions available and bursaries. So we hope that price doesn't become a barrier for people to be able to attend.
And I hear there might be free books.
Yes, this is what I'm really excited about as well, and merchandise. I know that you also, Anna, are a big fan of merch. So yes, there will be some free proof copies, and Headline are going to bring some of their other treats down with them. We're going to end the day as well with a drink and a bit of a celebration and a book reading as well. So it really is going to be a really joyful afternoon.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I had a rare little bit of time to fill at the end of the show today. So I wanted to take a moment to give you a list of fantastic book and writing related things going on in the city in November, which I think you will enjoy and you may not have heard of. So this is actually on the last day of October, but there is an event at Brighton Waterstones called Queer Gothic with Chloe Michelle Howarth and Leon Craig. I absolutely love Chloe Michelle Howarth. She is delightful and a brilliant writer. We loved having her at the Coasters Queer. So this is at 7 o'clock, and they will be in conversation to talk about their latest novels, Heap Earth Upon It and The Decadence. Highly, highly recommend that. Then the Real Writers Circle, also friends of the show, have an event on Tuesday, the 25th of November from 6 to 8 p.m. titled How to Build a Writing Career. So this is with Amanda Prowse, described as the Queen of Family Drama, who will be joining them. Amanda is the author of an astonishing 31 novels across multiple genres, two non-fiction titles and several short stories. Her books sell in the millions, and her latest page turner, Ever After, is out now. She's also often on TV and podcasts and blogs. If anyone knows how to build a career from writing, it is Amanda, so you should definitely go along to that. I know they always sell out at the Real Writers Circles, so do not miss your chance if you'd like to go. On the 25th of November too, if you don't fancy a bit of Amanda, you can pop to Waterstones Brighton for an interactive murder mystery evening. So to coincide with Christmas, Anthony Johnson, author of Can You Solve the Murder, has masterfully crafted a brand new fun, festive, interactive murder mystery evening designed to give audiences a taste of what they can experience from the book. So the activity begins with Anthony setting the scene by reading a gripping description of the crime scene and victim, followed by statements from potential suspects. The audience, which is you, then takes on the role of detectives in groups, choosing who they wish to interrogate further and ultimately deciding who they believe is the murderer. To add a festive twist, the event will be set against a Christmas backdrop with holiday-themed clues to enhance the experience. There will also be mince pies and other festive drinks, snacks and decorations to make it a truly unique, merry experience. So I mentioned earlier in the show the value of online writing retreats, and Writers HQ are running one on the 16th of November from 10 a.m. It's free to everyone, and there will be thousands of words written from wherever you are in the world. So check out the Writers HQ website to find out how you can enroll on that. And on November the 4th,
Writing Our Legacy bring you a workshop called Journalism Basics, What is Journalistic Writing?, which is an online session hosted by Maria Ahmed, which will cover the essentials of journalistic writing from content, language, structure to style and voice. That is on November the 4th from 5:30 till 7:30. We will be back next month with more book-related delights, including one of my favourite things to do, which is our Christmas gift guide with Elizabeth Perry, one of my favourite book friends. So whilst we squirrel away recording that, hope you enjoy the show, hope you can catch some of these brilliant events, and we'll see you next month.